All right, this is tape one, side B. We were talking about what expectations you had when you were about to leave high school, and we were talking about the difference between a scholar and what you are now. You were talking humorously about that. You mentioned writing. I'm sorry, I should let you complete it. You thought of becoming maybe a writer, anything else? Any other routes that you thought you might take?
Probably writing was what I thought I really wanted to do.
Right. And what kind of writing? You say fiction?
Yeah, fiction.
Did you have models? Did you have authors that you were reading at the time that you thought you wanted to maybe model yourself on these people? Faulkner jumps to mind, but
Faulkner jumps to mind.
Right.
And in my freshman year of college, I decided I wouldn't take any more English classes, and I just wouldn't do anything with that. I ended up having to take another one for distribution, but right from the start, I got this horribly bigoted Southern professor. How did this work? But somehow he decided that I was really evil, and he tried to fail me in his course. So I had gone through these are the days before grade inflation, okay? So I'd gone through 2/3 of the course getting A's.
Right.
And then I wrote a review, book report, but an analysis of a Faulkner short story. And I said something that apparently deeply offended him. So I got an F on this, and then I failed the exam, not just failed, but zero, so that he could give me a C. And then, because my father was on the faculty, he said, well, you know, you could fight it, but you shouldn't fight it. So I ended up not fighting it. And then I just said, if that's what they can do in the field, if it's this arbitrary, then I don't want anything to do with it.
Right. Yeah. And this was in your senior year?
It was in my freshman year of college, my first semester.
At Vanderbilt.
Right.
Do you regret that decision at all, then? Or? I mean, you still, I guess, what
No, because that didn't really keep me from... That just kept me from taking English courses or being that type of academic.
Right.
And I don't think I wanted to be an English teacher.
Right. But the writing writing fiction, creative writing, did you still want to pursue that, let's say? Maybe not academic teaching of English.
Yeah, I probably was still toying with this idea until I graduated from college.
And that's about when, your interest in science began to kick off?
So, yeah, my interest in science was really when I graduated from college and couldn't get a job for a long time. And then I finally got a job in a pharmacology lab at the medical school at Vanderbilt. And that was really a lot of fun. It was incredibly hard work. But then I understood what science was. It wasn't just knowing all these facts or being able to do all these calculations, which wasn't hard for me. It just wasn't interesting. What was interesting was asking questions and sometimes getting answers. So that was the first time I had ever been exposed to that. I had gotten absolutely no exposure to that in college.
All right. Before we talk a little bit more about that period, how do you decide to go into Vanderbilt? And were there other schools that you applied to? I know that your father went to Vanderbilt.
And taught at Vanderbilt.
Right.
So that's the answer.
Okay.
I applied to two or three other places. Virginia. There's a liberal arts school out here in the East County.
Oh, like Occidental College?
No. It's, there are four or five of them together.
Oh, Claremont College.
Claremont.
Yeah.
Pomona's and Pomona.
Mm-hmm.
So those were the three that I ended up applying to, Pomona, Vanderbilt. But really...
Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. And you've already described partly part of your experience in that first year, a dreadful experience with this English teacher. But what was that first year like other than that? What was that transition like? Did you leave your peer group, or did some of them move along with you to Vanderbilt?
I guess about half of them went to Vanderbilt.
Mm-hmm. And was it still that group? I mean, did you still... You're still fairly close?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did then get new friends.
Yeah.
I think the people I was closest to did not go to Vanderbilt.
Right. And, again, what was that first year like?
See, one, it was very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hesitate to say I actually learned anything in college. But I had essentially taken the first year of college and my last year of high school. So I passed out of chemistry and taken the first year of calculus.
Right.
So I was taking... The second year courses, organic chemistry, and second year calculus, and I don't know what else. It was hard.
Mm-hmm.
In that horrible English class.
How did you pay for college? I guess I'm getting at too. Did you work?
No, it was free.
It was free.
That's why I went to Vanderbilt.
All right. Oh, because you're a father. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I'm sorry. That should have been explicit instead of implicit.
Okay. And you say you didn't learn anything in college or much. Why was that? Was that because of you? Because of the college itself? Was it timing?
No. I guess Vanderbilt's a reasonably good school. And certainly I learned calculus, but not in a way that I ever will use again.
Right.
The chemistry, I learned lots of facts, but never really learned what the questions were. That's going back to this idea of the difference between facts and science.
Right.
So it was a technical education rather than a question-asking education. So as far as science education goes, I am now deeply impressed how poor science education is in this country, that we do not teach students how to ask questions, what the nature of science is. We only teach them the nature of facts.
Mm-hmm. Did you have, besides the science classes, did you have other interests? I know that you pretty much end your attempt to be an English teacher.
Let's see.
Were you taking like other liberal arts classes, maybe?
I took other liberal arts classes. As an extracurricular activity, I joined the theater and did lots of backstage work, lighting or sound or stage construction.
Hmm. Okay. Did your older brother, Lee, did he also go to Vanderbilt?
Mm-hmm.
Did the rest of your siblings go as well?
We all went to Vanderbilt.
Yeah. Oh.
That big free...
Right. That's too tempting to pass up.
We all tried to get enough scholarships to convince our parents that it would cost less, but it was, in those days there were no academic scholarships.
Right.
Or very, very, very few academic scholarships. So there weren't very many opportunities.
Okay. How would you then sort of sum up your college education? If you had it to do over again, I guess, I mean, what would you change about it? Other than, again, putting the sort of problem-solving science foremost rather than fact.
No, not problem-solving. Why don't I answer it this way? If I was, since I don't know if I was to do it again, I mean, I love being a scientist. And with retrospect, I would say, okay, let's do a better science education. I think a liberal arts education is also valuable. And I did actually get a good exposure at Vanderbilt to some liberal arts. But I would design a science education that forced kids into lab settings earlier. And I don't know how to do the other thing, and that would be have small groups that could discuss it like you would sit around discussing a novel. So instead of saying, here are the facts, here are the questions, or this, these are the 10 other things I want to learn now that I've read this paper. And we don't do that. We have a hard time doing that with graduate students.
Right. When you're near the end of your college education, you said earlier that you had, I mean, after graduation, you eventually joined this pharmacology. Was it a company? Or was
No, it was a lab at the medical school.
Okay.
As a technician, just someone who pipetted, things like that.
And what was your expectation when you did that?
That it would pay my rent.
Right. And how long did you do that?
I did that for 2 years. And then I decided, because I just went there because I had to have a job. And Mr. Reagan had made this terrible recession, and there were no jobs.
I remember that recession, unfortunately.
So I had no intention of making a career out of that. I was just going to spend a few years paying the rent.
We haven't talked about your social life at all at this time. Were you dating much in college?
Yeah.
So you had a social life, which is...
Yeah, I had a social life. I don't have one now, but I did then.
You can look fondly back on it.
Oh, that's what that is.
Right. When you are in this lab and you're sort of really becoming excited in science for the first time, what was the next stage for you? What did you decide to do?
So I decided that... I like doing experimental science. I liked the short-term questions, and I was thinking I needed to learn how to ask the long-term questions. I was working on human blood stuff, platelet coagulation, blood coagulation. And I actually didn't like doing those actual experiments. I didn't like working with people because they were too variable.
As people will be.
And I said, well, you know, if we just had people that were all the same, the experiments would be better. I said, well, that's genetics. So I said I should learn to do genetics. That really was my rationale. I should, maybe I'm interested in evolution, and maybe my math is good enough that I'd be good at the quantitative biology, the population genetics, something I absolutely hate now.
But it connected with mathematics, which you did enjoy.
Yeah, so I applied to a bunch of genetics departments, and I talked to a bunch of evolutionary geneticists, and thought, so the story I tell people is that I went to Stanford. I talked to Covelli Sforza, who's a famous population geneticist there. He was in the middle of his Italian, in his work on migration effects in population genetics, and he was getting all of his data out of Italian telephone books.
That's amazing.
So his office was stacked with Italian telephone books. And it just seemed like the craziest thing I'd ever heard. So I said, well, this guy's crazy. And the rest of the department, just nothing attracted me. Mm-hmm. And then I went across the bay to Berkeley, and I talked to one of their famous evolutionary geneticists, and I thought he was even crazier. He's now dead, so I won't say his name, but you can repeat this. Covelli Sforza is just crazy.
Okay.
I later learned that he was one of the founders of molecular genetics, who did this really beautiful molecular biology of recombination in bacteria. Mm-hmm. So he has got great credentials. It was just the population stuff. So at that point, I had been accepted to the genetics department at the University of Washington. I had no idea that it was actually the best genetics department in the country at that time. Mm-hmm. I had just applied there because I said, well, it's the Northwest. That's, if I have to move somewhere and then drop out, that's where I want to drop out.
Really? So it was purely geographical reasons.
So I, after finding that I didn't like Stanford, didn't like Berkeley, I said, I'm going to just drive up there and see what it's like. And I called them up and arranged interviews, and they said, well, we thought you were interested in evolutionary genetics. Did you want to speak to Joe Felsenstein? Mm-hmm. I said, I don't know where you got this idea. I was interested in evolutionary genetics. I'm an experimental biologist. Then it turned out, I ended up really liking Joe Felsenstein's work, but I never worked with him.
Right.
Which, I don't know if that was a bad miss or not, but it was funny in retrospect. Mm-hmm. If I had started there instead of in the Bay Area, I might have ended up a population biologist.
Right, right. So you finally end up at the University of Washington.
Right.
Okay. That's good. And describe at least what was that experience like?
That was wonderful. I started working on yeast genetics. Mm-hmm. And it's like the perfect thing to learn how to do science with, to learn how to do genetics. Mm-hmm. The generation time is really rapid, so you can make a model. It can be stupid as anything, but at least you've shown you're wrong within a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the first projects that you undertook? How did they evolve?
How did they evolve? Oh, God. So what actually turned into my thesis was what I actually started on. And in the middle was all my playing. Okay? So I was, the lab that I was rotating through, a large fraction of it worked on this gene called CDC4. Mm-hmm. And presumably now we know a great deal about what it does. At the time, it was just a sequenced gene in yeast that there were mutants for. And the lab had its models of how it might work. And we wanted to know where in the cell it was. So my job was to make a fusion of this protein gene to LacZ. LacZ is makes a protein called beta-galactosidase, which is a great little enzyme that turns a store-bought chemical, cuts it in half, and you get a blue product. Mm-hmm. So that's one great thing about it. And then there are great antibodies to it so that you can visualize, you can take the antibodies against the protein and see where it is in the cell. And this was the gene I was working on was a very low abundance gene. We knew it wasn't expressed very well, so we were going to need to have other techniques to find out where it was, just as a first initial question, not a hypothesis testing type of thing. So I made fusion proteins and overexpressed them and found that they, when I overexpressed these truncated fusion proteins, the first one I made was just took off a few amino acids, but it no longer worked. I later made fusions that were full length and then did work, but the first ones didn't work. And when I overexpressed them, they killed the cell with the same unusual phenotype that the loss of function mutant did. So that was something we really had no background in the field at that time. It's now a field called that's routinely used called dominant negatives. And at the time, we didn't have any experience with this notion. And I thought, okay, if I can overexpress this non-functional protein and it gives the same phenotype, then I can use this as a really sensitive way to do a structure-function analysis. I'm not dumbing this down, am I? I can use it as a way to probe how the protein works, because I can, different parts of it could then jam up the machinery, and I can ask which parts are jamming up the machinery responsible for one phenotype, or it turns out responsible for jamming up others.
Right.
So the first thing was when I, that got me hooked was when I overexpressed it and it did the same thing as if it hadn't been made at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what kept me going on that. In the middle, I learned how to ask questions about other people's hypotheses.
Mm-hmm. And who were the other people? Or were there other people who were influencing you? Teachers, mentors?
Yes. So my thesis advisor was a man named Breck Byers, and he was, I suppose, a great mentor. It couldn't be more different than how I mentor people.
In what way? How would you describe his stuff?
He would listen to me. He would occasionally throw out ideas. Once a year, he would beg me to do an experiment I had started but hadn't finished. And then he would go, if he was confused, he would just look at me and say, I'll bet you can figure this out.
And then he'd walk away.
Right. So that was one. And from him, I got more of this notion of you can actually explore deeply into a problem really without formal hypothesis testing. He wasn't, I would say, a formal hypothesis tester.
Mm-hmm.
He was an explorer. The other mentor, who I probably talked to 5 times in my research there, was Lee Hartwell.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the guy who got the Nobel Prize, I guess, last year. And the original mutant came from his lab. And he was a very formal thinker and had developed many of the ways many of us now do experimental genetics, the way we think about our problems. So when I would think about my problems, I would think about it from those two men's viewpoints. What would Breck do? What would Lee do?
Anything else about Lee Hartwell, though, about his mentoring style? I know that you didn't.
I barely talked to him at all. He was sort of a mentor in absentia.
Right.
He was down the hall. I'm sure he saw me running around all the time.
Right.
Once I wanted to use he had a lot of money. My lab had virtually none. But I had sort of learned from a previous experiment, the lab I had worked in after college, that if you're actually doing science, people don't mind you using their resources.
Right.
So I would just go down and use all their stuff. And then one time I was thinking about using a drug that they had that I didn't have access to, but they had, so I had access to it. And I was starting to set up a fairly large experiment. And I think he heard me ruminating out in the hall, okay, how am I going to do this? And he actually came out and said, well, maybe that's a little expensive and we could tone it down first. That's like the only direct advice he ever gave me.
Right.
Was slow down first. So I wouldn't actually call that mentoring, but maybe.
All right. I'm interested, I guess, in listening to you now. I mean, you get accepted at, as you said, you know, the best program, one of the best, at least, in the country. You're going from a lab, a pharmacology lab. What was the work that you were doing in the pharmacology lab? In other words, Describe, I guess, a little bit more of that transition, because obviously that work must have made some impression upon these people at Washington.
I don't think so.
No.
I suspect I had a letter that said that I had good hands and I could think.
Right.
But I don't think they cared that I actually... I mean, they probably cared that I had achieved something, that I took some very difficult procedures and made them work reliably.
Right. So technically they were...
So technically, and then I could take the data and analyze it in ways that the people who, you know, my job was to feed the data to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, my boss at that time, and she wasn't... She's a very powerful scientist who I respect deeply, but she was in too much of a hurry. So she would look at her way of doing the analysis,
mm-hmm.
and it and say, well, not this doesn't work. And I would say, wait a second, all we have to do is normalize this, normalize that, and average this, and then we have results that are meaningful.
Right.
So I think I impressed her that I could turn, I could make experiments work that other people couldn't.
Right. Now, did you have much lab experience when you were at Vanderbilt? You didn't, did you? So what led to this, this sudden explosion of technical proficiency, I guess?
Some people just have good hands.
Right.
I no longer have good hands.
you don't have to do much bench work anymore.
All I do is breed fish.
Right. Breed fish and write papers.
And write papers.
Right.
But I don't do any of the molecular biology anymore.
Hmm. Okay.
But at that time I think I developed really good hands.
Right. Was there a group of people, too, that you were communicating with that were helpful and sort of bouncing ideas off of? Or was it just you?
When I was a technician?
You're right, when you were in college or that.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, there were very good people, but
mm-hmm.
The types of questions that they were asked, I was really superficially interested in how can I make my experiment give data that someone else designed and asked the question for.
Mm-hmm.
How can I make it so that the data works so that I'm productive instead of I did the procedure but nothing, but it's garbage. Okay.
Right.
Which is not, if my technicians approach their work that way, I would be pleased.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them, no, they are alive. They might see this. I won't say any more about that.
Okay.
They still work for me.
Mm-hmm.
I can piss off big shots, but not the people who work for me.
When you're at, was it a joint lab, Rick Byers' lab and Lee Hartwell? And did they share?
They shared quite a bit. They one of the rooms was shared. The initial mutation set that Lee Hartwell had developed, Breck had done the cytological analysis, that is, cutting the cells open and looking and seeing what they actually look like.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not a formal collaboration, but it was an intellectual symbiosis.
Right.
Because they had very different styles.
And if you would describe, too, what was a typical day like for you? When would you come in? When would you leave?
Gosh, in grad school?
Yeah.
I would probably get there by 8:30 and leave around 6 and go home and cook dinner. I even used to cook back then. Mm-hmm. And then I would read for a few hours, maybe 3 or 4 hours.
Right.
And then... Yeah. So my typical day would be walk in, pick up a cup of coffee, and start doing whatever.
Right. Did you work on weekends as well?
I would work one day or 1.5 days on weekends.
Right.
Maybe just one day. I had a social life in graduate school.
Oh, that's good. And what was the general mood of the lab? How would you describe that lab, a joint lab?
So both labs were great. The interactions were what you would make of them.
Right.
Okay, so some people in Byers lab wouldn't really go out of their way to interact with people in Hartwell's lab, and others would.
Right.
So they were both really interesting labs because it was a great time to be developing ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, at that time, Hartwell's lab was developing the really fundamental ideas on cell cycle control, not just the cell cycle genes, but the what makes cells stop, and not just what makes them go, but what makes them stop.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an incredibly exciting time, even if you weren't in their lab. If you're nosy like I am, you're still paying attention and participating.
Mm-hmm. All right. You pursued a PhD, I don't have the date in front of me, but nine years? I'm sorry.
I started in 85 and I left in 90 and got my PhD in 91.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. And you eventually do your postdoc. Before we move on to that, though, what do you believe was your most important achievement in the Byers lab? I mean, several important articles come out of that, obviously.
No articles came out.
Really? So it's just your PhD. But you had, you contributed on certain articles.
Right. So Breck doesn't publish very much. He hates to write.
Mm-hmm.
If I have one criticism of him, he can't teach science writing. So I did not learn science writing in his lab.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, and it's not his fault that I didn't learn. I could have learned somewhere else, but when I look at it, the chapters of my thesis, which could have been published, they were not written as science. I mean, they were written as technical achievements. And I don't think he was ever comfortable with that. And we spent 6 months trying to write, and he was never able to tell me, this is what's wrong with it. He would just say, this isn't right.
Mm-hmm.
And my postdoc advisor actually taught me this, so that I'm actually now a fairly good writer.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So we didn't get those papers published. A postdoc who had been in Breck's lab needed that data published, and he ended up publishing it and putting me on the papers. But I it's fair to say I didn't get papers out of my PhD.
Hmm. Okay. Describe the transition then from your graduate work to your postdoc.
So, in my graduate work, I was just sort of playing around and exploring. And then I decided that I wanted to study cell growth control, but in a vertebrate. So now that means cancer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeast has cell growth control, but it's not really the same thing as cancer. And we can learn a lot from yeast. But once we learn from yeast, we need to start applying that to a vertebrate, something that actually does get cancer,
mm-hmm.
and seeing what new things we can learn that what we learned in yeast doesn't actually, what's missing from our yeast lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that I needed to come up with a system that would let me do in a vertebrate what people could do in yeast. And I don't mean the molecular biology that's so incredible in yeast, but just the ability to manipulate it, find mutations, and then manipulate the physiology with those mutations. One of the great things about yeast is they grow at a wide range of temperatures, so you can find mutants that work at one temperature, but then you heat the yeast up, and that otherwise wild-type gene product falls apart and doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something we call a temperature-sensitive mutation. And it lets you turn the gene on and off at will. So once you've found the mutants that are like that, they're really great for doing experiments with. You can ask, when in the life cycle of the animal is the gene acting?
Mm-hmm.
Or set up even more complicated experiments. I wanted to ask, for instance, if you had tumors that you had... I haven't done this yet, by the way. I hope to one day. If you have tumors that are induced genetically, we think tumors are induced genetically. That mm-hmm. is, they're missing gene function, and then they progress to a tumor. So the key to that statement is tumors progress. They keep accumulating mistakes. They keep losing different gene functions, and they get worse and worse and worse, and then they really take over the body and kill you.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be able to take away, find mutations that caused cancer, but then be able to, in my experimental system, add back gene function and ask, is that tumor still bad, or have I caused it to be a normal tissue again?
Right.
And if once I have things like that, can I ask how long can the tumor progress? And eventually, what other problems does that tumor accumulate? Do the cells in that tumor accumulate before it can no longer be fixed by adding back the causative
mm-hmm.
gene? The gene, the loss of function was causative of tumorigenesis. So that was the experiment I wanted to do. And I thought, okay, so I need a system that is really a flexible growing system. You can imagine yeast grows as a colony,
mm-hmm.
and even though it's individual cells that you can think of as organisms, you can think of the whole colony as the organism, and it's giving you views of that organism at different times in its development. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
It's a very simple yeah. way of thinking about development.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted something like that, but in a vertebrate. So you could think maybe like if we had a worm that was growing by adding segments.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Worms aren't vertebrates, by the way. Some of my colleagues would read that and go, God, Steve never did get biology. But you could imagine then doing a genetic manipulation, like changing the temperature while it's making this segment, and mm-hmm. it continues to go on, and then you restore it, and you've both got the old segments to look at that mm-hmm. were developed wrong, and then the new segments that formed after that. So that's what I wanted, except vertebrates aren't worms, and they're not yeast. And mostly vertebrates grow up. They make an embryo, and then the embryo sort of just enlarges.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not much you can do about it. But some vertebrates, you can amputate tissues, and they'll regenerate. So that gives you multiple views at the same tissue within that organism.
Right.
Sort of like replica plating
mm-hmm.
in bacteria or yeast. You can challenge that organism at one condition, ask what happens, then cut off that fin, let it grow back again, cut off that limb, let it grow back again under a different condition.
Right.
So I wanted to do that, and I saw that zebrafish would regenerate their fins. And at that time, people were just starting to show that you could develop it as a genetic system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I went to do.
Okay. That's what you proposed.
That's what I proposed to do. And I mutagenized some fish, and I cut off a lot of fins and looked for mutants. And I never really found the mutant I was looking for.
Right.
But that was my transition.
Right.
Was trying to test that hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. All right. And let's talk. I'll ask you the same questions I asked about the lab, Myers Lab. What was it like working in that lab?
So this, again, was an amazing environment.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in Jim Weston's lab, And, well, I have to give you a little more background, and you will probably, over the years, you've probably talked to Marnie Halpern.
Right, right, we have.
And then you've got several other zebrafish people coming. Mm-hmm. A guy named George Streisinger had started the ball rolling in the 70s, right? So this is like 15 years before any of these postdocs show up.
Mm-hmm.
And he just decided he wanted to develop genetics in a vertebrate. He wanted, I think, to study eye development and physiology and perception. And he was going to use the zebrafish because it had these clear, beautiful embryos that develop external to the mom. And then he spent his contribution was in developing ways of manipulating the sperm and the eggs, how to make mutants, and then how to look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he died in the 80s. So while I'm a graduate student, there's all this talk about what George had done, and, oh, wouldn't it be great if people could actually do this? But George is dead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the time, so George was a geneticist, a classical geneticist, but he left behind him people who were interested in what he was doing, who were developmental biologists. So Chuck Kimmel and Judith Eisen and Monty Westerfield, and then Jim Wesson, who actually never worked on the zebrafish himself, but put together the big program project grant to pay for the zebrafish.
Right.
So even though I was in Jim's lab and Marnie was in Chuck's lab, we had pretty much equal access to everything. I mean, not precisely, but we had equal access to the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us had more crazy ideas that we were pursuing, like me.
Right.
Like Marnie was pursuing very precise, beautiful ideas. And we talk about it now in retrospect. And, you know, she says, well, you had freedom that I didn't have. But then I had a lot of risk, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an amazing place because everybody talked to everybody. We really did.
So there was much more interaction then.
So yeah, it was like the yeast group in Seattle, but now the fish group in Eugene. And it was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I was doing my really half-baked idea, I was learning embryology from the work of people like Marnie.
Right. Mm-hmm. Before, this is sort of backing up a little bit, but had you applied to other places other than the University of Oregon?
For a postdoc?
Right.
Initially, I only applied to do zebrafish at Oregon, and I had initially talked to Chuck, and Chuck had said, no, he's full, which meant this is a harebrained idea. And he said, but maybe Jim Weston's interested in actually starting a zebrafish lab, and he's interested in harebrained ideas.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't quite say it like that, but
right.
That was... So I went and talked to Jim, and Jim said, that's really harebrained. If you can get money for it, you can join my lab.
Right.
So I spent a year trying to get money, writing this precise thing. And finally, I did get some money.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ended up getting two grants that I could... One from... One that was something Jim was on the board of, so I think he manipulated it, but
mm-hmm.
that was okay. And then I ended up getting an NIH grant, and I manipulated it so that I had 4 years of funding, which actually did give me, most postdoc grants are up to 3 years. So it gave me a lot of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Okay, I forgot what your question was, though.
About why, had you applied to other places for your postdoc?
So I spent a year applying for funding, and when the third to the last one said no, this was like 20 grants,
mm-hmm.
and the third to the last one said no, I started applying to others.
Right.
And like 2 or 3 weeks after that, like one thing, I had thought of a really great yeast chromosome instability lab. And I'd written them and said, you know, it looks like I really wanted to do zebrafish for this reason, but I can't. But chromosome instability is very similar to what I'm interested in. And can I work in your lab? This is someone who had worked with Breck Byers in another one of the yeast labs,
right,
himself as a graduate student. So then he called to get the references, called Lee Hartwell. And Lee Hartwell was talking to me in the hall. He said, I just got a call from Tom Petes, and he wanted to know if you were really interested in this postdoc. And I was opening this letter at the time, mm-hmm, and there was my money. And I said, you know, I'm not.
Deal done.
So no, I didn't. I mean, I only looked when I looked like I couldn't get money for zebrafish.
Right.
And then I did.
Okay. We're near the end here, then.